Hello.
Hi, we're good to go.
All right, perfect.
All right, so let's start with your year of graduation, including if that was spring, summer, fall, and your major.
All right, absolutely. So I officially graduated and earned my degree in August 2011, so that was summer.
Yep.
My major was music business, and I believe I was the entrepreneurial track at the time.
Oh, cool.
And my primary instrument was voice.
You anticipated my next question. Excellent. So, yeah, all right. We will get to your history later. By the way, do you like going by a Thomas or Tom?
Tom is fine.
Tom's cool. Yep. So, we'll get to your history later. But for now, tell us about your current job. What do you do and where do you do it?
Sure. So, right now, I'm an investment banking associate for Barclays Investment Bank in New York City, basically Times Square. So it's definitely a crazy place to work, especially bring your family to. I have two young boys who are 3 and 5 years old, and my wife, who's currently a full-time student at NYU in the dental school. But it's a super exciting place to be. Barclays is a little bit history on the company.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about Barclays? Like, how big is it?
Yeah, so it's a very big bank, right? They're based out of originally started in London in the late 17th century, so they've been around for a long time. It's a wholesale and consumer bank, which basically means we do retail banking, personal checking and ATM, think about debit cards, checking accounts, things like that everyone usually has. And then, same thing for like corporations, so corporate banking and then investment banking, which is where I am. And then we also do private wealth management, which is managing high net worth individuals' money and helping them to, advise them on where they should put their money and whatever, things like that.
Is there a typical cutoff for what someone would...
High net worth individual? I think it's I'm not sure what it is. I think it's like, you have to be earning over, let's say, $200,000 a year and have like liquid $1 million in capital right now or something like that.
Gotcha. So, yeah, up there.
I'm not in that side of the business, right? But
sure.
And then we also have a big credit card business, which is called Barclay Card. And then mainly, we have big presence in the UK, which is where it's based out of, obviously, and then the U.S.
This sounds like there must be tens of thousands of employees.
Yeah, there's 80,000 employees worldwide, and then we operate in over 40 countries. Our biggest competitors are, going to be J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America Merrill Lynch and, on the investment banking side, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. So, it's definitely what you call a bulge bracket bank. It's too big to fail, you can say.
Sure. And you said you're at the investment banking side. Do you know about how big that is, let's say, in terms of American employees? Like, how many people are in your office?
I don't know off the top of my head. It was basically Lehman Brothers after they went bankrupt in 2008. Barclays came in, bought them out at a very good price, and then rehabilitated that business. And, we've done quite well since. But I can't really say in terms of number of employees off the top of my head.
But it sounds like substantial. It's not a 5-person operation.
No. It's thousands of employees.
Sure. And you said – go on.
So, I guess I should talk more about exactly what I do.
Yes.
So just to talk more about the investment banking side of the business – and this is how I think about it, right? Like I started in July, so I'm still relatively new to this business and this job. But this is how I kind of think about it.
Yeah, started in July of 2018.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So the way I think about it is, an investment bank really has two sides. There's the public and the private side. So on the public side, this is where the investment bankers will work directly with customers who want to, invest to make certain investments into stocks, and you'll have your research analysts there, like providing, recommendations on what to buy and, what to hold, what to sell. They're dealing mostly with public information. And then on the private side of the investment bank, you have, the reason why it's called private is you're dealing directly with the clients and with private information.
By clients, do you mean the companies you've invested in? Or
No. So these are like the companies themselves where we're not making investments into. We're just providing like advisory type services for them. So we don't. There's a real strict rule in investment banking where the private side, there's a lot of regulation around the private side really talking to the public side for obvious reasons. When you have private information that if someone could get a hold of, could make a substantial amount of money or could cause some serious damage in the public markets. Which think about like insider trading or something like that,
right? Well, in that case, could you just explain this? Speaking for Puivi, this is very interesting, a little new to me, because when you're saying you're on the private side, are you talking about the companies that are getting invested in? Because otherwise, right, it shouldn't matter whether you tell an individual or, you get what I mean. You're not telling some other person, not affiliated with, I'm making up a thing, Apple, that, now's a great time to buy Apple.
Say Apple's our client on the private side, and Apple says, basically what I was going to get into is on the private side, we'll work with clients directly with services that and advise them what they're looking to do. So like raising capital is obviously a big piece of it, and then obviously offering them advice in terms of strategic type things like mergers and acquisitions is what we call it. So like buying other companies or selling a piece of their business or selling themselves. Doing an IPO, going private, things like that. And say Apple comes to us and says, hey, we want to raise a bunch of equity in the capital markets to invest into, smart cars or something like that. And then that's private information, which the public could then trade on if they knew it. So if that information leaked, and then so that's why there's a real
Yeah, I understand.
Around it.
I think I had been a little confused as to who the clients were on the private side, but I understand now. And I'm sorry, do you work on the private side or the public side?
So I'm on the private side, and then, the private side is broken down a little bit further just to make it easier for the listener. The way I think about it is there's product and then coverage. So an investment banker will work on the product or coverage side. And then just really briefly on the product side, there's three main groups. There's equity capital markets, debt capital markets, and then something called leveraged finance. So equity capital markets groups, the investment bankers will be experts in raising capital in terms of, issuing stock into the market for a client or taking a company public. Mm-hmm. In the debt capital markets group, you're mainly just issuing corporate bonds and investment grade debt, things that are low risk, that are highly rated by like Moody's and S&P. And then in leveraged finances, just think about it as like risky debt, things that are going to earn an investor high return. It costs more money for a company to issue that debt because they have to pay a higher interest rate because they have a higher risk of bankruptcy or defaulting on the debt. So it's what we call non-investment grade or just higher risk or high yield. That's the product groups that specialize in specific, services and products for the customers mm-hmm. and then for clients. And then on my side of the business
which is the coverage side.
Yeah, and in coverage, we work really closely with our product groups, but basically we advise and work with our clients in finding strategic options and services that will meet what they're looking for or what they're looking to do in all aspects. So we're the trusted advisor with, let's say, used Apple as an example. So let's we'll go with that. So say Apple comes to us and they say, they're looking to grow or they want to buy a certain company. And the way that they're going to buy that company, they would never have to do this because they have so much cash on their balance sheet. But let's say the one way they're going to do it is to issue debt to pay for that other company. Then we would, as a coverage team, would do a lot of the analysis to value whatever the other company is worth, which involves a lot of financial analysis and modeling and due diligence. And then we would work with our debt capital markets team or maybe even leverage finance, which wouldn't be the case for Apple since they're investment grade. But basically, we would work together as a team to execute and get this deal done, as we would say, our transaction. And then the business model for an investment bank is we mainly earn fees. So let's say we bring a company public, and the company is going to issue you know, let's say the value of the transaction is going to be, I don't know, $500 million, then maybe we'd earn 5% of that $500 million. So it could be a lot of money.
Sure.
You know, but it's not like these deals take a lot of time. There's also risk that they don't happen. You know, let's say there's a lot of, you know, and you read about it in the news a lot about companies merging, and there's antitrust issues, and which could take months for courts to say like this is okay, or you know, or it shouldn't go through for you know, reasons that would protect consumers and things like that.
Sure. So I don't ask what people are paid, but I'm a little bit curious about the structure of your pay, since you talked about how this can be very deal dependent. Like, yes. Are you on salary? Do you get commissions, big bonuses if you hit a target? Like, how's that
work? Yeah, so the way it works at the junior level, so I'm still considered more on the junior side.
Yeah,
so
what's your official title, by the way?
So my official title is an associate. So the way it works in the investment...
An associate what?
It's just investment banking associate.
Got it, yep.
Yeah. And so it's very traditional business line, right? So it's really structured. Generally, if you were to do this job, so I got an MBA, and so I started the job right out of, you know, getting my master's degree in business. Mm-hmm. But if you were to come out on the undergraduate level, you would start out as what's called an analyst. And then you would do that for like 2 to 3 years, and then you'd become an associate, do it for about 2 to 3 years. It's usually 3 years, and then you'd become a vice president, which would do that for about 3 years, and then director, and then usually the top of what you would go towards is what's called a managing director. So at the junior level, mostly
vice president is the middle of the three ranks. That's kind of funny.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah. But that's vice president, a very specific little field, right?
I mean, it's a little bit different maybe than like other fields of work, right? But that's just kind of how it is at all the investment banks.
Sure.
And so the pay structure is generally at the junior levels, you get a very generous base salary, and you get a, you know, pretty generous bonus at the end of the year, which some of it is based off performance. There's generally three buckets. So if you've done really well, then you reach like a certain percentage of your base salary. And then most people will get the middle bonus, and then there's a lower bonus bracket for, you know, if you need to like step it up next year or something like that.
Gotcha.
Which less people get that. And then as you improve or as you grow and over the years you become a vice president, then your bonus potential, it gets more linked to your deal flow. And then, you know, as you become, let's say, like a director or a managing director, your bonuses are much more tied into the business that you're generating and the deals that you're executing. And so there's obviously a higher payout and reward for that. And I'm not an expert at this because they only told me so much, but
sure. I'm not going to personally, but if somebody were in the middle group,
yes,
in terms of bonuses, like what fraction of the year's salary is the bonus? We talking like 10% of the year's salary?
I don't know. I mean, range could be like maybe like 60 or 70% of your base salary.
Okay, it's pretty hefty for.
Yeah, it's generous, but you know, the line of work is, let's just say that you're at the junior level, especially your life balance can be pretty difficult to achieve.
Sure. But how many hours a week do you work?
Yeah. So, you know, can range if I'm busy, like, you know, could, I would say just this, like anywhere from like 75 to 100 plus hours a week.
Wow.
And so if you, like, there was a, something I was working on, for about a month, and, it was a live transaction, and, you know, it was pretty common that I'd go in at around, like, let's say 9:30, 10, and then leave at around 3 a.m.
Oh my God.
And so, but that's like when you're cranking on getting a deal done. And then on an average week, you know, it's more like, closer to like the 65, 70 hours, 75 hours. So, but you know, like that's why I think the pay structure is that way. And you know, I think it's a great place to launch your career and build a lot of contacts and learn a lot about, really the world, the way the world works in a lot of ways.
Sure. So can we go, let's do one of the quote normal days or weeks. Like, Could you take us through, kind of hour by hour, through what a typical day for you might look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So generally I get into work around 9:15, 9:30. Get to my desk. It really depends. If I'm on it's kind of weird because you don't really have a typical day in this job. Your day could be
you could make it a typical week if the days vary too much.
Yeah, it's let's just say that if I'm not staffed on a live transaction, meaning that, you know, we're not mandated, we're not working on a specific deal that needs to get done for a client. Like let's say again, like an IPO, right? Like this IPO needs to happen. So every day I come in, this is all I'm working on. I'm like grinding it out, you know.
Can you just say like what does working on or grinding it out mean? Like for you, it's very obvious, but for listener, like what is it that you're actually doing when you're quote working on IPO?
Yeah, sure. It's kind of hard to say because there's a lot that goes into it, but it could be anything from just doing a financial model in Excel, so like building out the financials of the transaction, to putting together like literally slides and presentations and investor presentations, it really just ranges on what you're doing. But generally, I think, you know, for the listener, not to get too much into the weeds here, I think you can think about what you're doing at junior levels. You're going to be working in building models, financial models in Excel. And then you're also going to be working a lot with PowerPoint and building presentations, pitch books, and presentations and doing that.
Presentations for the clients.
For the client, a lot of times for the client. If you're working in equity capital markets group and you're going on a road show though, where your main job is to pitch the equity to potential investors, then it may not just be for the client.
Got it. By the way, do you work as part of a team?
Yeah, so generally broken down into – on the coverage side, you're generally broken down into different industry groups. Mm-hmm. So I'm in the real estate industry group. So I work mostly with big real estate companies that are public and private, mostly public companies that, you know, let's say like on the – and then it's broken down further into like sub industries or sub verticals – like healthcare or self-storage companies or retail, office, stuff like that. Sure. And then, of course, you know, other industry groups would be like consumer and retail, financial institutions, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I'm mostly in real estate. But kind of getting back to my everyday.
Yeah.
Because we kind of got a little off track there, I think.
So good, man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so you were saying you start off, if you're working out a deal, you just spend all day cranking. It was like, what is that? And then that got us all into that. But, okay, let's say you're not going all in on one.
If I'm not doing that, then I'll come in. I might be working on two or three different projects that I've been staffed on by. There's something called a staffer in my group that basically, you know, a managing director might speak directly to the CFO of a company who wants to explore a potential idea to buy another company. And then in which case that managing director would tell my staffer, hey, can you put together a team of, let's say, two to three guys that can help me build out a model and put together a deck, a PowerPoint presentation that we could then go back to the client and say, hey, this is what it would look like. This is how much you might have to pay to buy this other company or whatever. And then my day would be working on that stuff. You know, doing the research, opening up a lot of times we're working and just looking at, you know, financial reports of companies like 10-Ks, 10-Qs, things that are, you know, have to be issued, that are mandated by the SEC for a public company to have. And then we're getting a lot of the information there to then build out, these models. And then if something goes live, then we're going to be getting a lot of the information directly from the customer or the client, that's really, you know, now private information, to do, you know, more in-depth due diligence. So, you know, this is digging into, you know, all aspects of their business to really make sure that we understand, you know, what is this company worth, where are the risks, and so forth.
Okay, got it. By the way, do you personally have some certifications? I know there's some exams and certifications that a lot of people working in finance have.
Yeah, absolutely. So to be an investment banker now, you have to pass something called the Series 79, mm-hmm. Which is a license to do the job. You just study and take a test for it. And you have to get like a 73 to pass. They're timed exams. And then you have the same thing. There's another exam called the Series 63, which you have to take as well.
Gotcha.
So before you can even start the job, this is what you have to do. So I technically didn't start. So I started in July of 2018, but I technically didn't start like the actual job until like the first week of September of 2018. Because the first month they do internal training, and then the last month or so, or for a couple of weeks, you're just studying and like, you know, to pass these exams to get your series license. And then if you don't pass, then they give you like one more chance to do it. And if you don't, then you're like, you can't do the job.
Yeah, I got it. Well, I hate, what's the pass rate?
It's not that bad. It's, you know, I think it's pretty high. It's pretty high. The investment banks, you know, hire, outside companies to come in that train you up and like basically help you to figure out the best way to pass. And then, you know, the people that are getting these jobs are coming from, you know, the best and brightest, or are the best and brightest from like top institutions. So they already know how to study for exams. And I think it makes it a lot easier, given the fact that like you already know how to study and pass other exams.
Sure. Makes sense. Well, hey, Tom, one criteria you had to hit in order to qualify for these interviews is that you enjoy what you do. So if you don't mind sharing, what is it about being in, you know, working in investment banking, or, you know, being an investment banker associate that you enjoy?
That's a really good question, and I agree with it 100%. I think it's important for anyone to do what they're doing is to really enjoy it. So for me, it's just really being a part of the pulse of the economy. You know, the transactions that we're doing are big transactions that really change the landscape of the economy and industries. You know, you have to have your finger on the pulse of what's going on in the markets. You know, what's going on with Jerome Powell? What is he saying about interest rates? It's like it's an adrenaline rush because you have to be a part of it all. And I think it's exactly why I wanted to do this job. I just wanted to understand how money flows throughout the world. I wanted to really get a better grasp on, you know, what makes the economy go and move. And I think being a big investment bank, you know, in New York especially, is you're kind of at the hub or the centerpiece of kind of like driving the economic machine, if you will, and so it's an exciting place to be. It's not an easy place to get to or to get into. But I think, you know, if you're someone that has like a lot of passion and drive to kind of like understand and see how, you know, kind of the world really works, and how money flows, then I think it's a great place to be. So it's super exciting to do the job. It's also really cool because you know, the clients that we're working with are big companies, and a lot of times you're talking with and you're on phone calls with, you know, C-level executives, and where you get to listen in and get to be a part of conversation. That's a pretty cool thing to be a part of and a big deal. You know, like if I were in the tech group, then it would be companies like, you know, Spotify on the music side, right? Like, or I think that might be the consumer, media group, but, you know, I'm on the real estate side. So a lot of people don't know the real estate companies, but, nonetheless, they're very big. Like you go to a hospital and the chances are that one of the companies that we work with are probably own that hospital. And it, you know, they're just not like consumer-y type brands that people know. Sure. But But if you are in one of those other groups, then like consumer and retail group, you know, your client's going to be, you're going to be working with, let's say, like CFO or of Home Depot or CVS or something that like people know. And so it's really cool to be a part of it all. And I think it's experience that, like, you know, a lot of people don't stay at an investment bank forever. A lot of it's especially at the really junior level, like at the analyst level, the undergraduate level, like I think 80% of the people leave after 2 years, and it's a launching pad to go work for, you know, another company at a higher level position than you would have if you just were to start, you know, at the, more at the lower ranks right out of school. Or, you know, you can go right into private equity or venture capital, or go back to business school, you know, with a much higher chance of getting into like an Ivy League school or something. Mm-hmm. And then at like the associate level, similar prospects of going to work for another company. Maybe you can even become the CEO or CFO or CEO of a smaller company and get a chance to run that company. You know, or you could just stay and become a managing director, and now you're working directly with these clients as a trusted advisor, and you're really moving markets. So it's pretty cool.
Gotcha. A lot of opportunity.
Absolutely.
All right. So, hey, let's take it back to 2011 now. Although yeah. If you feel this story has a logical earlier starting point, we could take it back earlier than that. But okay. I mean, guessing you weren't thinking investment banking.
Not at all.
Okay. So put us in your headspace as things were wrapping up at Berkeley, or again, if you want to go earlier. And then we'll take it one step at a time from there to where you are now, both what you were doing and kind of where your head was at.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I didn't know what investment banking was at all back then. I was still very much interested in doing something in with music. Taking it actually a little bit back further, I originally went to Berkeley hoping to be a performer, but I always had this interest in business. And then, you know, I was thinking, should I do a performance degree in the school? And, you know, maybe my dad had something to do with this, but, you know, I was thinking if I graduate with a performance degree, you know, and say the music thing doesn't work out, I might have less leverage, or I might not learn as much as if I learn something more tangible, which is might be, or more useful, might be business and learning about economics and whatnot like that. But even more so, if I wanted to be a musician, it would help to understand the music business to be more successful, to monetize my music, let's say. So I thank God I had a little bit of insight like that to do music business, because when I started doing and taking the classes, and, you know, one of those classes was yours, and it was economics, and I loved your, like, I wrote this to you over LinkedIn, but it was true. Like 2 days or 3 days before you had messaged me, I literally brought you up, and because we were talking about, you know, what makes it that some people get a spark for something, and become like some successful in doing something along those lines, and one of the topics was, you know, having a professor or someone that like really engaged you and opened your eyes to something. And, you know, and you were actually did that for me in the economics class, and I loved it. And I just remember, like, I lost a lot of interest in some of my music classes, and I started gaining this really, like, passion for just understanding, you know, like, you know, this is how I kind of like to describe it, how the world works.
Sure.
And
thank you.
And so, yeah, no, it's true. And so you know, there were other classes too, like even the principles of business class. I forget the professor who teaches it. I think he's still there. But I really like the fact that building a business plan and thinking about all the pieces of how to do it, and how creative that was, to think through all those pieces. And I started to get this real fire inside of me, about how interesting it was to, like, create something that would be my own. So that's why I did the entrepreneurial track, because I didn't – at the time I was like, yeah, I can go work for a record company, because I know they have the record or company track or something like that. And it was like, yeah, I could work for a company, or I could, like, create my own business. And at the time I was still thinking, like, I could be a musician and create my own business, like, make money and be a musician at the same time. Maybe they'll somehow intertwine. And so I became super excited. Like I would wake up every day full of energy to kind of create some kind of business idea. So that's where I was headed. Like I'd say when I started taking these classes, and then by the time I graduated, I had done some internships with a company called bandsintown.com, during the end of my schooling. And also I did an internship. Both of these were unpaid. I did an internship with TKO, which is a music agency in New York area. They don't exist anymore. If they do, they're a subsidiary of the agency group. They got bought out.
Sure.
So it was fun. I could be part of these like really cool, smaller, like more entrepreneurial type startup businesses that are involved in and around music.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I graduated in 2011. It was very difficult. I asked.
Yeah, not a great year to graduate. 9, 10, 11 were all pretty terrible.
Yeah, still pretty bad. And I struggled to convert any of these internships into a paying job. And I had asked outright, like, hey, like, you know, could you pay me? And I wasn't part of the lucky people that didn't have to take out loans for school. I had a hefty amount of loans on my plate. And so, I had some time to kind of like, you know, figure out what I would do before the payments kicked in, but they soon did, right? And mm-hmm. so I was, you know, I had some odd jobs. I was working as a chef at a country club in Long Island, New York, where I grew up.
So you're from Long Island. It sounds like you moved back home after graduation.
Moved back home because I didn't have the gig that I was working. Like I was at bandsintown.com, right, which is a Boston-based company, startup, but I think it got bought by some app company, I think, but, they weren't going to pay me, and they were like, you could keep working for free. And I was like, all that energy and time, I don't know if I could do it. At the time I said yes, but realistically it was not realistic. So I went back home. I took back the chef job I had, like that I used to work at over the summer sometimes. I think I was getting paid like 12 bucks an hour, which was okay. And then it was a seasonal gig though, because it was a country club and golf for it was a golf club.
Sure.
And so November came around, my student loan payments started kicking in, and I was like, crap.
Why is the golf club's closing down?
Exactly. Like perfect timing. And, that was not a long-term gig anyway. And I was like, what am I going to do here? Like I want to do something, that I'm passionate about. I still had that passion for entrepreneurialism. So I was like building my own business plan. I had like a ton of recording equipment I was accumulating over the time. I was like recording some people in the local neighborhood. Like I was getting paid like maybe, I think a few people I was recording for like 30 bucks an hour or something like that. Really basic recordings, just trying to like build something up. But it was difficult, right? Like I didn't have capital to really do it. Who was going to listen to me like working out of my mom's basement? So I needed a job. So I took a job trying to stay in the music business with Guitar Center. And, it's
the sales floor there.
Sales floor. Yeah. I wasn't even that. It was November and it was a temporary gig. It was greeting customers at the door. So my official title was greeter.
Oh, and, started at the bottom.
I started at the very bottom, and my whole job was just smile and wave and maybe direct people to some things, and that was it. And I came in for 3 to 4 hours, 3 times a week, and I was like, man, I really need this to turn into something. And it had an end date. It said, after the Christmas season is over, you'll work for maybe a week to kind of help with the returns, but you don't really have – it's not something set in stone that you'll get a job after. In fact, you probably won't. And so I was like, I basically said, like, I can't let that happen. So I did the best job I could possibly do. And I walked in the back, like, you know, the same week that my job was ending. I was like, hey, like, I really need this job. And the manager said, you know what, come back to me next week when things settle down. And it was really his way of saying, get lost. Huh. And so I went back the next week, and I think he was amazed that I actually came back. And I said, hey, like I came back, like you said, like, and he took like forever to like come back, and see me. I was like waiting at the front for like 2 hours, and they were like, the kid's still here. Like, can you please talk to him?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. And
this is so like, combination of inspiring and pathetic.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it was in a way I had nowhere else to go, at least that's what I thought. And, And so he said, you know, I have this recording class that nobody will teach on Saturdays. I think it was Sunday or Saturday in the mornings. And will you teach it? I'll give you a full-time job. And I said, yeah, of course. And at the time I was like, yeah, I said yes. And I was like, I don't know how to teach people about recording. So anyway, long story short, I took the thing. I taught the class. And, you know, it was a sale. It's a sales gig at Guitar Center. So it still is today, I think. Mm-hmm. And which basically means, and at the time it's different now, it's better now for the employees, but at the time it was basically 100% commission. So they paid you $7.25 an hour, which is minimum wage at the time in New York, and you faded against it. So like you sold, you made a certain percentage on everything you sold. It was like 3% on the gross profit of the product, and then like 10% of the gross profit of the product, and then 10% of the 3% of the overall gross price. And so it wasn't a lot of money in the beginning, and then it faded against the minimum wage, which meant
if you made less, you got minimum, and if you made more,
yeah, exactly. If you made more, then they subtracted out the minimum wage you got, then you got the only what was above the minimum wage.
Yeah, it's sort of like how waiter waitress tips work.
Okay, so it was all right at the time. I kind of like was, you know, I did the job for maybe about like a few months, and I was like excited, but not really. And I was still trying to like record people at home. And I was like still in this, like, I'm going to build up a recording business somehow.
And I'm guessing what your pay there was probably coming in a little north of minimum wage, but not hugely.
Yeah. Maybe like 10, 9 or 10 bucks an hour. It was all better. But so anyway, I didn't really see the potential. So what wound up happening was I found, you know, my now wife, and she lived in Queens, and, you know, obviously things accelerated fast there. I you know, soon knew that she was.
Congratulations on finding her. You just. Well, yeah. Do a diversion. Can I just ask how you two met?
Yeah. So one of my friends, from Boston is a comedian, and he was touring, and he was in New York City, and he reached out to me like, hey, you should come out. And I was like literally not going to go. And I last minute was like, all right, I'll go. And, at one, you know, went to a bar after, and literally I met my wife at the bar and never thought it was going to turn into anything, and just stayed in touch, and then became what it is now.
Well, fantastic.
And for, you know, 5 years. So yeah, it's a crazy story. anyway, it became the fuel for like waking me up, let's say, and saying like, okay, like I want to be able to take my girlfriend out at the time, like to dinner and do things. And so how can I do this? And being in the job, so I always said Guitar Center can be the worst job you ever had, the lowest paying job you ever had, or it can be the best, highest paying job. Well, not highest, but let's say at the time, the highest paying job I could have. Mm-hmm. And I just believed that. And I'm an avid reader, and I like read a bunch of sales books, and I read, I still do, and I still read a bunch of like self-help, you know, inspirational, like you can do whatever you set your mind to type books. And so I did that, and I like just was like, you know what? Like I could say that this job is not that great and not paying me enough, or I could say this job is going to be amazing and I'm going to sell everything that they have to, you know, to sell here. And I did, and I sold a ton of stuff. My income rose a lot. I started turning heads from management. You know, they quickly made me assistant store manager. Then I moved to the Queens store, became a sales manager, which is, you know, basically the right-hand man for the store manager. And then, very quickly, then I went to the flagship store in Manhattan and was a sales manager there, which was their biggest store, doing about $26 million in revenue, overseeing a sales staff of about 60 or 65.
What, you were overseeing the sales staff?
Yes.
Wow, how long did this take you? Like, when did this?
I did this probably within two and a half years.
Fantastic.
That's just off the top of my head. And then, shortly they made me a store manager. So they gave me my own store back out in Long Island, in the store that I started in, which was in Comac, New York. So I kind of did this big, like, you know, circle, and then I was running my own store. And along the way, I kind of knew, like, I figured out that I could do, once I knew that I could, like, you know, my income rose to about, like, When I was just making commission, not as a sales manager, I was making maybe $50,000-$55,000 a year.
Wow.
And then as a sales manager, I was making $65,000 a year. Then with bonus potential on top of that, based on how the salespeople do in the store, which I think came out to be $72,000 that year. And
well,
then
considering you've been just north of minimum wage before, that's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. And then they gave me my own store, and then I made around like $80,000-$85,000 a year. So not even that much more to run the store, because I think, you know, I was young and they're like, okay, well, we'll give them 85 and whatnot. But
I mean, that's still for working in music. It's just been a couple years out of college, making it in the '80s is solid.
Yeah, no, it was great. And I was happy with it. And it was plenty of money for the time. But my passion became greater along the way, and I started to know, like, all right, well, if I can do this, if I can become a top salesperson here with nobody really, you know, I had a lot of help. I had mentors and things like that within Guitar Center, and they gave me the platform to do it. But, you know, really the fuel came from me believing in myself. If I can believe in myself doing this, well, what if I could believe myself doing something even bigger than this? And so I always took that passion that I got from, you know, Berkeley and the music business program, sitting in your class in economics and just wanting to know more about the economy and knowing about finance and Guitar Center. We were, working with investment banks, you know, as a corporation to gain more liquidity, to reinvest into our business, to pay our employees more, to pay down our debt and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And being a manager, I was obviously like, not at the table in those conversations, but I was informed on what was going on. And I was like, you know what? Like, I want to be there. I want to be sitting at the table with people who are owning these businesses, who are making the decisions about, you know, what to do with their money and how to grow their business and how do we move ahead. And I started researching and figuring out how do I get there. The really only way, and so I figured out, you know, I want to be an investment banker. So I knew that before going to business school.
So do you remember about when this was? This like 2015? Yeah, so
this was 2014 maybe.
Okay.
Because it was like about 2 years of like studying the GMAT, taking it, and then going to business school, which I went in around 2016 and then graduated in 2018.
Got it. So 2014, you want to be at the table. It sounds like you're concluding that the way to do that is to be the investment banker.
So I was happy with Guitar Center. So the way I looked at it was like, all right, I could do this in two ways, right? Like I could study for the GMAT and go to business school and try to do the best I can. And if it doesn't work out, then I'm doing great at Guitar Center. I could, you know, my next step when I was on path to become a regional manager or district manager, and then, you know, where you're managing like 8 or 7 stores, and then the next step would be regional manager. And then you could, you know, I think the CEO, not at the time, but the CEO when I first started was like literally someone that started in the warehouse. And so like I had these inspirational stories that, you know, they would most people roll their eyes at, but I was like, you know what, like I like this. I think this is pretty cool. And I think most people that work at Guitar Center are more interested in just continuing their music career. And where I was just kind of like leaning more into the business aspect of it.
Sure.
So anyway, I studied for the GMAT. I also did a lot of research, and the only real way to get into an investment bank from business school is you kind of have to go to like a top 20, 25 school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I researched what those schools were, what I needed to get in, you know, how to build my and craft my application. And obviously GMAT was a big part of it. And that took a lot of my time. I was literally like reading and studying at work on my breaks. And then like going, everyone was like laughing at me, like, what are you doing? They're like, why are you like, you know, studying about, you know, hypotenuse triangles and stuff like that. and I was like, no, like, you don't understand. Like, this is going to be great. Like, I'm going to go to business school and all that stuff. And it worked out. Like I studied and I wound up getting,
I took the GMAT a long time ago.
What's that?
I said I took the GMAT because I used to tutor the GMAT before I worked for Berkeley.
Oh, really? That's cool. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I studied for it. I took it once, I think in, let's say, late 2014. Uh-huh. And I got like a 620. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it's like, you know, it's good, but it's not going to be good enough to overcome the fact that I went to Berkeley. My GPA is not that high, and I'm a little bit non-traditional to get into like a top 20 business school. So I applied like NYU just to throw it in, and like I didn't get in. And so I like kind of put it on the back burner, but then like restarted it and went in hard and studied for another, you know, 6 months or so. Took it, wound up getting like a 710, and I was super psyched. And then I applied to schools, and I was able to, lucky enough to get like a pretty good scholarship opportunity to go to UNC, which was like, you know, had good pipelines into investment banking and was like, you know, right where I wanted to go.
University of North Carolina.
Yeah. University of North Carolina, the Kenan Flagler Business School. And it was also, so along the way, I had my first boy, Daniel, and then I think, you know, eventually wound up having my second one, Leo.
So your wife came down with you to.
Yeah, so my wife came down with me. We all moved down, and I did the MBA program, and it was amazing. And it's like the experience was just insane. Like,
yeah, what was it like to do that MBA program?
Yeah, it was super fast paced. I had to do this pre-program, or I didn't have to, but I thought it was wise. This like pre-program they do where they like brush you up in 3 weeks on like finance and accounting, and some statistics and marketing, I think, and then like in late August your school starts, and like at the same time companies are coming to campus, like a ton of them come every day of the week, and you just have to like do well in all your classes, and then like make sure you're getting to all, you know, whatever the industry, like if you want to do marketing, you make sure you go to all the marketing meetups with the companies, and you know, you it's really like right out of the gate, you know, everyone's dressed in suits. You got to go to these meetings. Like, you know, you have to be ready to show up. Right. And you just started class. So like I'm meeting with investment bankers, and I have to like, I don't have to know everything, but you have to talk somewhat intelligently about what you want to do with these guys. And like, you barely know.
Gotcha. So actually, quick tangent off that in terms of what you wanted to do. Did you go to business school thinking you were going to still be working in the music industry? Right. Think you'll be the investment bank for music, or were you just like, I want to be in investment banking, period?
I thought just investment banking, period. I really just wanted a chance to get in. It didn't occur to me later that there was a possibility of being like, you know, record company, like Warner Music. I don't know what it's called today. But like the music business does have investment bankers, and Barclays works with them a lot. And it didn't occur to me at the time that like, hey, I could be an investment banker to like the music industry. I was actually thinking more at the time, investment banker for retail companies, because that's the business that I became to know. Like Guitar Center at the end of the day, we sell music products, but it really just retail. So, you know, I started to understand, you know, the trends of the retail business, you know, and all of that. I became super interested in it. So I was like, oh, I'll do that.
Okay. So it feels like, well, initially it felt like you were working in music after some number of promotions, you felt like you were a retailer and more business person than in music specifically is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Gotcha. So back to business school, by the way, how does it stack up in terms of feeling intensity to like studying music business at Berkeley?
Yeah, I think a lot more intense. you know, it was very intense. Like, you know, I think life at Berkeley is a little more balanced in terms of music business. And then obviously Berkeley's, there's a lot I could say about it. There's, you know, it's, you're really dual majoring, right? Like if you're music business, you're studying business, but you also have to study, you still have to study your craft. And right. Study, take all the music classes. So it's like a dual major. And so I thought Berkeley was intense because you if you really wanted to do it right, and I don't think I did at the time, you know, if I were to go in with the same intensity I have now into Berkeley and to really, like, make sure I excel at every single class, I think it would be really intense because your attention is divided. As you know, being a music business student, and then because you're doing like statistics and economics and marketing, which like our marketing projects at Berkeley were like one of them was Microsoft Surface, which had nothing to really do with the music side at all. And then like my next class is like I had to put together a song with like five other people and do backup vocals. It's a lot to put on your plate.
Sure.
So, but at the time I like, you know, I put like a only attention into business classes, and I like kind of didn't really focus on music classes, so it was not as intense. But at business school, it was like I put 100% of focus on all my classes. I knew that these investment banks wanted to see like top grades, and they're really really selective, and it's, you know, hard to get in to begin with. And so I like pedal to the metal. Like I didn't see my wife at all, really, even though she was there with me. You know, kudos to her. She took care of the kids and everyone. And so it was intense.
Gotcha. So, when did you manage to line up your current job, and when did it become clear that you can do investment banking? Or I guess sounds like you'd wanted to be investment banking and then that just didn't change while you were there.
Yeah. So, investment banking, and then there's also another field that people at more traditional business schools kind of go towards these days, and it's usually investment banking or consulting, and the reason why those are, like, you know, they recruit really early, so generally you know you're going to get an internship like by January mm-hmm. of the same year. So I was like, I always had the model, like, you know, I'll be disappointed if I don't get an investment banking job, but if I don't, then I'll still be able to have opportunities to recruit with, you know, another corporate company, Coca-Cola, whatever other company, and do something else, corporate finance or marketing.
Sure.
Since investment banks recruit much earlier. But I wound up, you know, I had to fly to New York. Like, I think I flew to New York 6 times on Friday. Literally, I went there with a group of other people that were interested in doing banking. And, you know, we'd sit in a coffee shop, we'd email investment bankers, and then we'd try to line up conversations with them, and then they'd come out and we'd talk for 20 minutes and then try to build a connection, and then they go back into their job. And hopefully you build a connection enough where it's usually with the alma mater, like the alumni of your school. Uh-huh. So it's not – these people have no interest in like hiring you. They hope that they hire, you know, UNC grads. But hopefully you didn't scare them away in these little chats. And then the next step is they interview you. And the interviews generally took place in like January 3rd. So I had like no break over the holiday. I like literally locked myself in a room with one of my buddies, and we just like drilled each other on interview questions, on financial technical questions. And
this is all the first year.
This is all the first year. Wow. And then before the second semester even started, I had my internship. And the way it works in investment banking is if you don't get an internship, it's very low likely chance you'll ever get a job in banking. And then if you get the internship, you just have to make sure you convert it which at Barclays, thank God, you know, we have a high conversion rate. I think 90% or so of the interns like convert it into full-time job. So I felt comfortable, but you know, I was really nervous. But yeah, so it was an amazing feeling, like everything paid off, like, you know, all those years of like, you know, stepping, you know, grinding it out, studying for the GMAT and finally getting there. And then getting the offer was just amazing feeling.
And did you intern in the same group you're in now?
I did. So I ended up in the real estate group, and I wasn't thinking, well, I always had an interest in real estate. You know, I like the fact that it's tangible. I like the fact that you can see real estate as opposed to working in, let's say, like the insurance industry where you're just dealing with like financial contracts that you can't see or touch.
Sure.
And so it was interesting that like real estate is something that's always going to be here. You know, like if I work in the tech group, your hours are actually a lot worse because the industries and the trends are so fast paced and changing that like you have to stay on top of so much more. Whereas like real estate, it's the same business model more or less than that's been around for, you know, for a long time.
Sure.
And so I liked the fact that it was kind of like simple to wrap my head around, but also exciting, that I could become, you know, more of an expert, maybe at a faster pace. And that like I could walk in and see, especially being in New York, I could see the assets that like our clients actually owned.
Gosh.
So it goes back to your original question of like liking the job that you're doing. And I think a big piece of it goes into, I could have all the passion I want about finance and all that stuff, but if I didn't like the people I was working with, then the job would just be miserable. And so I wound up really liking the people that I was working with. I liked my bosses, the managing directors and the directors in the group. I thought they were like pretty hands-on and they got you involved and they really seemed to care about, you know, your development. And I was like, you know what? Like, yeah, I originally wanted the consumer and retail, but I think I could build a career here. So.
Gotcha. That's great. And by the way, when did you find out that your internship had converted into a real job?
They generally tell you on your last day. This is generally the way it works at Barclays is they give you a general offer. So then you rotate through three different other industry groups, mm-hmm. but it's kind of like trending towards giving you a direct placement into a specific industry group. And so, in order for them to do that, they wanted to feel out whether I'd want to do that. And so the head of the group, came up to me and like basically spilled the beans and saying like, hey, like we want you here earlier. And, it kind of caused an issue with HR, but was a huge sigh of relief for me. I knew about my offer like 2 weeks before the end of the internship.
And the internship is that summer between your first and second year of business school.
Exactly. So the so you get a full-time offer. Mm-hmm. They give you a very generous signing bonus. Most in all these jobs generally do. You go work for Coca-Cola in marketing or whatever, you're generally getting a signing bonus, which is nice.
And do they give you that right away, or do you have to then like – you've been there 90 days for real.
No, you get it before. I think mine came in like October. I'd signed my acceptance of the offer in like the end of August or early September, and I got it in like early November or end of October. And so, you know, you get paid for the internship, which is good, and then you get your signing bonus, and then if you have your job locked up, you like all that stress that you were feeling is like gone, and your second year of business school is like a dream come true. You can focus on your classes, but you can also like do all those things that you wanted to do that you never could because you were too stressed about like studying or all that stuff. Like you could travel. A lot of people will travel like, you know, for a little bit. I didn't do that. I had two kids, so I couldn't really just travel wherever I wanted to, but we took a lot of time. You know, I think we went to Disney for a little bit, and obviously I was still taking classes and putting a lot of effort into them, but kind of just caught up with my family and took a big sigh of relief that, you know, we knew where we were headed a year later back to New York, where I'm from and where my wife's family is as well. So it was nice.
Gotcha. That's terrific. And then, as you say, you graduated. Sounds like you finished in the summer over there. Or no, because you say you started your job in July, right?
Yeah, so I graduated Keenan Flagler in May of 2018, and then I guess had like some time until the end of July when my job actually started.
Gotcha, terrific. If you don't want to share, that's fine. But curious, like about what do these internships pay?
It's just a prorated of the base salary. I think it was like.
More than twice minimum wage.
Oh, yeah. It was like up 30-something thousand.
For a summer.
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrific. Wow. Okay, so, all right, let's move on to the third part of the interview of three. My first question for you, and there's no right or wrong answer, is these days, meaning the last 6 months or so, what, if anything, is your relationship with music?
So these days, and as I'm sitting here, I have two of my guitars hanging above my desk here. These days, it's definitely more of a hobby, something I really hope to get back into. You know, like I said, I had this home studio set up And working at Guitar Center, I had always gotten really nice discounts on gear. I no longer have that, unfortunately. But so I'd built up this nice studio. And then before I went to business school, I sold everything just to have some liquid cash, also less stuff to carry. And I kept some of my guitars and some other things. But I hope to get back to that. I hope to build that up again. I'm actually, now that I'm kind of settling into this job, and when I do have pockets of downtime, I'm hoping to kind of like get into, doing a little home recording again here and there. But I'm a singer, so like I carry my instrument wherever I go. So that's the good thing about it. And I can sing wherever I want. I sing a lot around the house, and, I sing a lot with my kids and, and then stuff like that. So.
Gotcha. So you're doing it at home, like to relax and.
Yeah. Exactly. I've sung in some weddings here and there, mostly like relatives and family, but.
Any in 2017, 2018 or 19?
Nothing on my plate right now.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So my next question for you is, I see there are many different paths to becoming an investment banker. I mean, business school, but many paths before that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing you're one of a pretty small minority of investment bankers who went to music college for mm-hmm. undergrad. Thinking about your current job and what you do now, assume you would have gone to college somewhere for something. But is there anything you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now?
That Berkeley did well to prepare me for now?
Yes.
Yeah. I think the business program aspect of it was great. Like I said, your class was really good for economics. I think, it really does provide a good foundation. I think a lot of people, when I say, like, I went to Berklee College of Music and I studied the music business, they don't actually think that I learned anything about economics or business, when I really did. And I didn't even realize it until I went to business school. And because, there was a large gap before going back to business school. Mm-hmm. And even sitting back in my accounting class, I'm like, well, I know what debits and credits are, and I understand an income statement and a balance sheet. And it was like, obviously I did a little bit of that at Guitar Center too, but a lot of it came from my foundation at Berklee in the music business program. So the good thing about the music business program is, while you learn about record contracts and the legal aspects of the business and, intermediaries like managers and agents and all of that, which is super exciting and really cool and something you can do, you also just get a really good business foundation. You're not learning how to like financially model out cash flows of a business and something to make like, how to model out investment returns and things like that. It's just not something, I think what you should be focusing on necessarily at Berklee, but you do get a good basic foundation for understanding how business and how you should think as a business person. Now going to the music side, like I think the music program is amazing. And ultimately, I think I have a lot of strengths going to Berklee because I've been exposed to such a wide range of personalities and a lot of creative mindsets. And obviously, being a musician and being around musicians is very creative. And it really does set you apart from a lot of other people. A lot of people that end up investment banking jobs that are super traditional, let's say a lot of people come out, they go to really cookie cutter schools and everyone tends to, tends to think the same way and they all try to fit in and wear the same, stuff and think the same way. And in a lot of ways, it is kind of like an aspect to getting a job. You kind of have to do that a little bit, but it also isn't that great. It doesn't lend itself to you being really successful in the long run because when it comes down to those projects or those moments when you need to think outside the box, you have to think creatively. And I think, being at a music school, whether it be Berklee or any other school, I think Berklee obviously did a great job there. And it's the nature of the school, but, it really did set me up for success.
Gotcha. That's great. Well, hey, let's turn that question around now because Berklee gives that one degree, a bachelor's in music. And you went there knowing that.
Yep.
But let's say all that said, is there anything where you look at your current job and you see, oh, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing or incomplete?
Yeah, I mean, I really think going to, you know, my experience at the MBA program at UNC and looking back at Berkeley, and where I think the school can do something better is we're very good. Berkeley's very good at training people how to use their craft and be really great craftsmen, right? Like be an amazing guitar player, very technical, good guitar player, and think creatively about how to use your craft. But I think the school fails in some way on how to translate that into like the real world. And it could have changed. This is my experience when I was there. But I think
it's a given that whenever people are talking about Berkeley, they're talking about Berkeley during the years they were there.
Yeah. And so my experience then was, I didn't know it as much at the time, but you know, I think like when I go to my experience in the MBA program at UNC, like why they're so good is they focus so much on what you're going to do outside of school immediately. And then the classes just support that. And I always thought that way. It's like Berkeley's an amazing place to kind of just like take 100 steps back, really dive into, you know, the music and the aspects that are really going to become make you an all around successful and amazing musician. But what I didn't get at the time was like, how do I become a marketable musician? How do I become like, how do you help me structure myself in a way that like is a product when I come out of the school? And it's kind of like you become a really great guitarist and then you get thrown out into the world. And then now it's up to you to create your product. And I kind of wished that they would say, hey, like they'd have like some kind of team of people that say, hey, like, what do you want to be a singer? Okay. You know, what is it that you want to sing? What is it that you envision yourself to be? You know, how do you envision yourself doing it? And what are the type of, you know, places that you see yourself singing? How do you see yourself doing it? And then let's use the classes and use the stuff that you're learning to get yourself there. And it didn't really have that feel. And so I think a lot of my friends and a lot of people who come out who don't have that mindset already kind of come out like a little bit lost and maybe amazing at their instrument, but then like not understanding where they go.
Sure. Very fair. All right. So next question for you there is you did talk about people feeling lost and, you know, sounds like you got yourself on a path. You decided, sounds like it was meeting your now wife. That was that real jolt of energy that said, I'm going to get myself real focus and direction that ultimately led you to where you are now.
Yes.
A lot of people haven't found that path yet. Maybe think people their first couple years after Berkeley who haven't gotten that jolt or met that person. And also, let's say people in their last year at Berkeley staring out into the big scary world and being like, oh my God, what happens next? So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
Yeah, so it's a loaded question, and I think the biggest thing that I would tell people is that you can definitely do what you want to do. And I think every student at Berkeley has big eyes, right? Like they go to the school and they want to do something to, you know, affect change in society with their music and, you know, have an impact on people. And it's just the nature of I think the students, which is an amazing aspect, which I think makes us amazing candidates for any kind of job. But I think a lot of people, you know, they have the big dreams and the big wishes, but what you need to do is take those dreams and really start to think about every piece of how you can make it successful. Cause you definitely can, But it's not only, okay, if I want to be a guitar player, I have to be really good at guitar. If I want to be a good guitar player, think about, okay, one aspect is being really good at my instrument, but the other aspect is what kind of music do I want to play? You know, how am I going to then, if, you know, one piece of it is touring and playing shows. How do I tour and play shows? You know, one piece of it is being able to feed yourself and live. How am I going to feed myself and live? And then how am I going to be able to meet the right people to, you know, get on tour with? Or if it's a band that you have, like, how am I going to, you know, be able to manage this and build a business kind of around it and be able to be successful at it? I think a lot of people don't think of it in a holistic vision, and they kind of just say they cookie cutter music out as like music is one thing, and they put it aside and say, you know, I can only do everything surrounded with music. But music is something that flows through everything. And so, and to be successful at it, you need to kind of look at it in at all aspects of it. And so, you know, I have a lot of friends, like you said, some of them are super successful and have done really well. And I think those are the people that look at every piece of the and are not afraid to say, you know what, I need to understand the business side of this, or I need to take to look at pieces that like I would never look at before. And then some of them, like, they think just playing like, you know, whether it be the drums or guitar or whatever every day is and just being amazing at it and someone will discover me. And I don't think that's the realistic world today. I mean, you're setting yourself up for, like, you know, hitting the lottery. Like it's not really gonna, you know, you'd have to get super lucky for someone just to be like, hey, you're amazing, I'm gonna invest in you and, like, you know, record you and put you out on the sound waves. Like, I don't think that happens anymore.
Sure, very fair. And now let's narrow it in a little bit. I think you're my 158th or 159th interview.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, first or second investment banker. So it's like,
oh, really?
Yeah. Or I think maybe first investment banker, but there's someone else who's like the, a principal at a venture capital fund.
Oh, cool.
So point is, like, who's listening to this interview and made it this far? Someone who's maybe even thinking about investment banking as a career and say, like, yeah, you know, the money's good. It seems like interesting work. So if somebody, let's assume they don't have an MBA yet, is thinking about investment banking as a career, what specific advice do you have for them?
I think you can definitely do it. I think it's the great thing about investment banking is there's a cookie cutter process to get in. You know, if you're at Berklee College of Music, chances are going into investment banking right out of school is probably not going to happen. Because it's super traditional. They like to look at the same schools over and over again, and they expect a certain few things on your resume. And those few things are, you know, for coming out of Berklee are going to be getting your MBA, getting it at, like, most likely you're going to want to shoot for a top 20 school, and you can definitely make the leap from, like, a top 30 school. But they like to look at the top schools first, and then it kind of, like, trickles down. And then, you know, really the biggest piece of it is, you know, work out in the world for a little bit, build up, you know, get a job in sales or marketing or some kind of, like, business line and then grow in that business, you know, get promoted a few times, you know, give back to the community. Like, something that I did, I didn't talk about, was I worked with my friend's nonprofit called Achieve in Africa, and we built a few schools in Africa.
Cool.
I mean, I did a small piece of that.
Well, did you go there physically, or did you help with fundraising?
I went there physically once before he started the company, and that's how I met him. Mm-hmm. And then he had started the company on his own, and then later I got involved on one aspect of it, which was something called Books for Bricks, and we helped to raise money, and that was really all I did. I didn't necessarily have hands-on with the building of the school, but that was something that the company did.
Sure.
And it was something cool to do. So do something like that. It doesn't have to be going to Africa. It can be something right around your hometown. Give back. Show that you're well-rounded. You know, if you haven't done music or business classes, that's okay. You don't have to be a business major at Berklee to do investment banking, but you should maybe take some finance or accounting classes. You know, just to kind of, like, show that you're interested, and then. You know, take the GMAT, make sure you do really well on it to get into a good school, And then the last piece of it, which is really winds up being the first piece when you get it, once you start recruiting, is be able to tell a really, really good story. There are people that are insanely qualified for investment banking that fail because they think that telling a story is not something they need to do because their resume is going to tell it all. And sometimes it does, but like, it's the first thing that someone's going to say to you when they're recruiting you is say, hey, tell me about yourself. And if you waffle it, chances are the rest of the talk or the interview is going nowhere. And if you can do like a 1 minute to 2 minute pitch on yourself, walking through like your background over the past, let's say 4 or 5 years, like everything I just talked about, mm-hmm. and just inspire them to say, you know what, I'm somebody that goes out there, runs through a brick wall and does something. Then I think you have a great shot at getting into investment banking. And I think, you know, some people will never understand music, but some people will think it's amazing and will think it's really cool. And we'll see you as a valuable asset because you bring diversity to the team. And that's what I was met with. You know, some people, there's no way I can convince them. But I was able to meet people and talk to people that thought, you know what, this guy's really interesting and cool. I want to work with this guy. If I'm going to work till 3 a.m., I want to do it with someone that's interesting to talk to. And so, you know, you do have a shot.
Gotcha. That's great. Well, hey, Tom, I just have one last question for you. Which yep. is, you have the mic. Is there anything we missed? Anything else you'd like to say?
No, I mean, I know that graduating from Berkeley and hopefully your head was on straight. Mine necessarily wasn't when I graduated, but I know it can be a daunting experience, and I know, you know, looking out to the world can be pretty frightening. But you know, you really do have a lot of power to do what you want to do. And, you know, I've been through a lot, and I'm definitely here as an alumni if anyone wants to reach out to me. And happy to talk to anyone. It doesn't have to be about investment banking either, you know, but you know, set your dreams high, set big goals for yourself, and I think you'll be amazed that, you know, you might actually hit them.
All right. Well, that's awesome. Hey, thank you so much, Tom. I really enjoyed this conversation, and great to catch up with a former student, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really happy you reached out. I was happy to do this, and let me know. You know, I'm happy to, you know, get involved in anything else that you might be doing and be a part of anything else that you might, you know, might be interesting or a way that I could give back.
I appreciate it. I'll at least once your interview's up, I'll make sure to point it out to a music business chair, Don Gorder, who's always really happy to, you know, when people are as successful as you are.
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. And it's good talking to you.
All right. Catch you later then.
All right. Bye.